Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. With the summer solstice just behind us and the summer sky laid out before us for the rest of the next couple of months, we thought we'd invite Tom Burns, director of the Perkins Observatory, back. And also, I did promise our listeners during the membership drive last spring that we would have you back for an uninterrupted conversation. So here you are. Welcome.
We're not raising money.
We're not trying to get anything.
Hi, Tom Burns. Give me a dollar.
But we do have the Peterson Field Guide to Stars and Planets with us, and you have your computer open for quick reference purposes. So welcome to the show, Tom.
In case somebody asks me how far away Albireo is, I'll be able to click on the star and tell them.
You know, I tried to get it scheduled so you could be on during this, you know, the day of the summer solstice, but it wasn't to be. But it did just pass, and now every day the days get shorter and shorter, or daylight gets shorter.
That's right. The day stays about the same.
But what is a summer solstice in astronomical terms? What does it mean?
Well, it's defined in several ways. In one, it's a moment in time when the sun reaches its highest point in the northern hemisphere at local noon, which, by the way, is not 12 o'clock, and it's 1:30. We'll go into that later. Or it is that point where the sun's rays are coming at their strongest angle down from the top. That varies when it happens according to the calendar from year to year, because the calendar doesn't quite match up with the 365 1/4 days it takes for the sun to go around.
Man's feeble efforts to control the
sun. Yes, right. Yes, the calendar is pretty much a mess and has been for a long time. But usually on June 20th or 21st, the sun reaches its highest point in the sky. And when it does, that is the summer solstice, which, of course, is the longest day of the year because the sun is up above the horizon the longest time. But interestingly, is not the day of the latest sunset. That happens about a week later at the beginning of July.
That is interesting because I've always thought it was the latest sunset. So the day, in some way, daylight is longer. How does that work?
Well, daylight is at its longest on the day of the summer solstice. However, the rising and setting of the sun are not centered around that local noon.
Is that what, when we get to this local noon conversation now, you're saying it's actually 1:30?
Well, there are a couple of reasons why our noon on the clock is not local noon. The main one is daylight savings time. That pushes it back to 1 o'clock. But this, and by the way, this is all artificial. Real noon happens at 1:32 because we are half an hour into the time zone. So the sun doesn't know we're half an hour into the time zone, and it gets to noon here a little bit later than it gets to noon because, you know, Earth is turning, than it does over there on the edge of the time zone along the Atlantic coast. So it turns out to be 1:30, but that's not the reason why the sun has its latest sunset. That has to do with the elliptical nature of Earth's orbit. That is, Earth's orbit around the sun is not exactly a circle. It's kind of a stretched out circle with two centers, as it were, called an ellipse. And that tends to make our... Well, it all comes down to the calendar. It's not perfect, okay? The number of days does not divide evenly into the year, astronomically speaking, in other words, and that tends to bollocks things up. But the second reason is that Earth's orbit is not exactly a circle, and that tends to bollocks up any attempt that we might possibly make in a calendar or a clock.
If you're just joining us, do not be confused by the voice. It is not Dr. Demento. It is.
Hello, it's Telescope Tom, the stargazer.
It's Tom Burns, director of the Perkins Observatory. You can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our Facebook page, All Sides with Ann Fisher.
It's funny you should mention that, though, because one of Dr. Domeno's favorite songs was Fish Heads. So now I'm going to be playing Fish Heads on my computer. My wife calls my voice the voice that only dogs can hear. So,
and that's something that only a spouse can say.
That's right.
So summer solstice is over with. Who cares? That's interesting, though, that the night we still that was curious to me because I've been wondering. It doesn't seem like it seems like the sun is setting earlier than I would think it would. So I just feel so illuminated there.
Well, I have to tell you, this time of the year is just agony for somebody like me. Now, you know, because of
the short nights,
it means I get more sleep. Don't get me wrong. But the worst problem is you're trying to run an astronomy program up at Perkins and going, maybe we can start observing when twilight is finally over at 11:15. Thank goodness, hallelujah, we've got some bright planets over there in the west, and sometimes the moon, so we can observe long before it gets dark. But my goodness, when there are no planets, this late sunset business is just a pain in the neck.
And more people probably want to stargaze, want to, you know, do the night sky thing in the summer, more lay people.
Yes.
More casual observers than they do in the dead of winter.
It reminds me of an old joke I saw on a Bazooka Joe comic, you know, that comes with the gum. Bazooka Joe's looking for a quarter under a street lamp. His friend comes along and says, "I thought you lost that down the street." Bazooka Joe says, "The light's better here." Well, it's exactly that. People love to go out in the summer, but it's a tough situation going out in the summer. You don't get a whole lot of sleep unless you get some during the day because you're waiting for it to spending most of the night waiting for it to get dark. However, there's a lot to see. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, I think it's tomorrow night or the night. Maybe it's tomorrow night is National Camp Out in Your Backyard Night or something like that. There was a story in the Dispatch about that today. So if people are doing that tomorrow night and they're going to camp out in their backyard with their kids and that sort of thing, what should they be looking for now? What's going to be cool to see when the twilight finally is passed?
Well, the first thing they should do is turn out all the danged porch lights. I mean, and have the neighbors do the same and hope for a giant power failure that wipes out all of Columbus. But the amazing thing about this, of course, is that even from your backyard, if you live in the middle of Columbus, there are still some things you can see, of course, except the trees are in the way, so you can't see them. But if you look over in the west, the first thing that's going to pop out, even in fairly bright twilight, is the planet Venus. And, oh, she looks beautiful over there, fairly low in the west. Like the goddess of love and beauty that she was supposed to be. And you'll know exactly why they called her that when you see her. She is the brightest thing in the sky besides the sun and the moon and is glorious. That's the first thing you'll see. Then up and to the left will be the planet Mars. And then up and to the left from that, kind of more in the southwest than the south, will be the planet Saturn. And they all form a beautiful line up there. In the sky. Just a gorgeous view, but you're going to have to get up off the ground to see them and make sure when you park yourself in your backyard, set up your tent, you have a little notch over there in the west so where there are no trees so that you can see.
Because it's close to the horizon?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
All the planets are right now, at least the ones that you can see in the evening sky.
The ingredients for life have been detected in deep space, and I'm wondering, thoughts? And have you changed your opinion about E.T.?
Oh, please. I get a kick out of these NASA press releases because, okay, so somebody discovered that there was, like, carbon and oxygen out there. But if you look at any nebula, places where stars are formed, you're going to see all of this. Now, if you can find them, I mean,
all together,
that's where you find them. I mean, our planet wouldn't have those ingredients if they hadn't existed in a star-forming region called a nebula, when was it, 5 or 6 billion years ago. So this is not startling news. And of course, and we've always known that the ingredients for life exist in space, in nebulas, even between nebulas and between stars in deeper space. The question then, of course, becomes, what are the circumstances under which those elements can form together into life? And apparently you need something like Earth.
Well, so if it's not new, then why is it being pitched as new? Is it just more ingredients have been detected?
Because every
or is
person.
Is it deep space, or is that the thing? Or
every college professor with a $250 million telescope and a $100 million grant to do research, or whatever it is, $10 million grant to do research, needs to justify their funding. And don't get me wrong, every time we find the elements for life, that means, well, the elements for life exist widely, things like carbon. We're a carbon-based life form, and oxygen and things like that have to exist out there. And every time we discover them someplace else, that's a good sign that they exist widely in our galaxy or widely in the universe. But I got funding to justify, you betcha, especially NASA, which is the biggest funding hog of all.
So. We're going to talk about that when we return from our break, because John Glenn just issued a statement on that this week. But I wanted to ask you, what about Perkins? How is Perkins supported?
Well, mostly we are supported by our $1.8 million endowment, which was all raised $25 at a time. This is no joke. From people out there like you in Radio Land. So if you write out a check and make it out to Perkins Observatory, send it to Delaware, Ohio, you will help to ensure the existence of Perkins Observatory. But people also pay for tickets for the programs, things like that. So it's all that. No funding.
No funding. It's all grassroots.
That's right.
The little people.
That's the way I like it. Thank you very much.
I don't know. Who called the – oh, yeah, the BP CEO for the BP. The little people.
Look, there's a little person. He's only 2 inches tall.
We're going to take a break right now. When we return, we look forward to your questions and comments. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. I'll return with Tom Burns in a moment. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Good morning. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher here on WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Emma Fett in for Amy Jurevich today. Some sunshine with a slight chance of morning showers and thunderstorms, a high around 85 today. Tonight, clear skies with a low of 62. Tomorrow should be some nice sunshine with a high around 85, and Saturday that continues sunny with a high around 90. Lobbyists on the loose in Washington, what do they want now, and what are lawmakers handing over? On finance, campaign spending, On Point gets the story. On Point goes inside today, coming up at 1 o'clock here on WOSU 820. Discover more about WOSU Public Media online at WOSU.org. You can sign up for the Daily News Loop for updates on the news sent right to your inbox. Get the best and trusted WOSU and NPR news and information every weekday. Sign up for it at WOSU.org. And now back to more of All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest this hour, Tom Burns, director of the Perkins Observatory, funded by people like you.
People like you, yes. You want a phone number? later,
we'll
do the
as usual,
number.
We'll have a link to the Perkins Observatory.
Tom Burns, give me a dollar.
We'll have a link to the Perkins Observatory on our website, WOSU.org/allsides, and maybe we can pop a little link on the Facebook page later today. Or maybe sooner that rather than later as well. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Dale, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. I have one question for Dr. Mento, specifically about one moon in August 9th of 06. It seemed to me to have been the largest, closest moon I've ever seen in my life. Is there any truth to that?
Well, the moon does have an apogee, an apogee and a perigee. That is, it gets something like 14% closer because its orbit isn't a circle either. But I have many times tried to notice the difference, and I haven't. However, there is an illusion, actually, that causes the moon to look bigger when it's close to the horizon. The full moon rises at sunset and sets at sunrise. So as the full moon is rising, people often see it. And the moon does look larger when it's close to the horizon. This is called the moon illusion, and it happens simply because you have something to compare it with. A tree in the distance, the horizon. And when the moon later on at 1 or 1:30 in the morning is up high in the sky, it looks smaller because there's nothing next to it to compare it with. There is a way of verifying this effect. This is going to sound weird, but it really works. Turn around and put your back to the moon as it is rising and bend over and look at it between your legs. And all of a sudden, because you've changed your perspective, the moon will look smaller again.
Ooh, that's weird.
Well,
this was a full moon. I know that from the calendar, at least what I understand from the calendar, full moon. And it was like you said, like about 1 o'clock up in the sky by itself. It seemed like I could almost touch it. It seemed huge. And maybe it was one of those moments when it seemed to be closer. I don't know. I never got over that.
Well, I've tried to observe the difference of 14%, and I just haven't. I've never been able to do it. However, another thing that will make a full moon look bigger, weirdly, is you need something to compare it to. So if there happens to be a jet contrail or a little wisp of cirrus cloud or something like that, or even clouds in the sky, they will actually make the moon look bigger. But it's all an illusion, or so they tell me.
Now I can't get that Dean Martin song out of my mind, though.
What?
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie?
That's amore.
Okay.
Never heard that one.
Really? Okay. We'll post that too. Dale, okay. Dale, thanks for your call.
When the moon makes you drool like a pasta fazool, that's amore.
Thank you for taking
Take
my
care.
Call.
You bet. 614-292-8513 or email allsides@wosu.org to talk with the director of the Perkins Observatory, Tom Burns. Okay, we brought up John Glenn.
Uh-oh.
retired Senator John Glenn, or former Senator John Glenn.
Former astronaut, John Glenn.
Though more pertinent to our conversation. He put out a statement this week bemoaning the demise of NASA and the funding that will end at the end of, is it 2011? At the end of this year.
Well, NASA will not end.
The shuttle and all of that.
What they did was end funding for the system that was supposed to replace the shuttle or cut it way back. Mm-hmm. And so NASA will be concentrating on things that produce more science, and that's unpersoned missions to the planets and things of that sort.
So the space station will have to hitch a ride with the Russians.
Yes. And
good thing?
You know what I say? Good. Because the Russians were smart. Excuse me for saying so, but in my opinion, I'll get into
this.
What
did they do right?
What they did right was that they have a couple of really good launch vehicles. One is what you might call the big dumb booster. You can use that to launch missions to the planets. You can use it to send an unpersoned truck into space to provide fuel and food and all of that that the space station needs. And you have the Soyuz spacecraft, which is good for sending people into Earth orbit. In other words, the mistake, in my opinion, and I could be wrong, that NASA made was choosing the shuttle in the first place. The shuttle was meant to do all of those things. So if you want to send a couple of people up to the space station, you have to spend billions of dollars to launch a shuttle. And if you want to send a satellite into orbit, you have to spend billions of dollars to launch a shuttle. And if you want to send some toothpaste and cheese doodles up to the space station, you have to launch a shuttle.
But can't they just kind of launch it all at the same time? I mean, is that sort of the
idea? Well, yeah, and that means that you can launch. You can't launch that often. Because it's so expensive. So you load up a shuttle with everything you can possibly do. But by the way, because of the space station's peculiar orbit, that's about all you can do is service the space station with people and with supplies. You can't send a satellite up at the same time. So if you want to put a satellite into space, I'm afraid you have to do that separately. That's why... The Air Force, the military, has its own set of special launches because they're often launching satellites.
So I know you're not a political scientist, but some folks worry that depending on other countries for transportation could affect us, just our national security down the line.
Well, that's why the funding for the launch system has not ended. It's just been scaled back. And NASA can continue to develop the kind of launch systems that are more practical. But NASA's problem with the shuttle in the first place, if I may say so, and I could be wrong, was that it was trying to create the Bradley fighting vehicle. I don't know whether you remember that. It started out as a troop transport and then everything but the kitchen sink. Mm-hmm. And that's what the shuttle was. It was like sending up a semi-tractor trailer rig when all you wanted to do was take a couple of people to Niagara Falls. In other words, it had to be everything to all people because it was the only launch vehicle. The Soviets were smart in that regard. And Soyuz is old, but it's good technology and it still works, and we can learn something from the Soviets. Develop the big dumb booster, develop a simple capsule-based system to launch people into orbit, and it's going to be a lot cheaper, and then we won't have to depend on people. And by the way, we could do it fast because there's a lot to learn from the old Apollo technology and the old Soyuz technology as well.
I thought it was interesting about the when we were talking earlier about we haven't talked about lunar water. We chat during the breaks, folks. little secret there. There's 600 million tons of ice apparently stashed under the moon's craters now. This is a new discovery or recent news.
Right.
And before that, there was little known moisture on the moon's surface and so forth. But the evidence came from samples from an Apollo mission decades ago.
Right.
And I thought that was kind of neat that they're saving it all. And when it's technology...
Yeah, I've been trying to get one of those rocks for the observatory for years, but it's too prohibitively expensive. You know, they have like 300 and some pounds or 400 pounds or something like that. But the point is, they ground up one and they found evidence of water in it. They found water in it. And what that means, folks, is that if we ever do go back to the moon, and thanks to the funding cuts, that won't be soon. Okay. Too bad. But anyway, then there is water that we can use, and water is important. Well, it's important for drinking, but you can also split it into its hydrogen and oxygen, and hydrogen is a powerful fuel supply, and oxygen you can breathe. And so, in other words, water is more than anything else. You're composed mostly of it. The element that we needed to make everything, practically everything else we need to set up some kind of permanent lunar base.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820, 614-292-8513. If you'd like to speak with Tom Burns, he's the director of the Perkins Observatory. We're talking about all things skyward today. Chris, welcome to the show. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. My question is, with the growing hype around 2012, is there any significance to a galactic alignment, and what does that really mean from an astronomic perspective?
Yes, let me think. Do a few calculations here. It means absolutely nothing. I mean, in other words, the sun takes about 100 million years to orbit the galaxy, but the galaxy is kind of moving with it, although all the stars have their own proper motion. And the galaxy is enormous in terms of its mass. Therefore, the sun being in one place in the galaxy, we're about three quarters out, and we're going to stay that way, by the way, and another place over the course of the difference between one year and another, first of all, is negligible. And even if you look at close in, I mean, there's a planetary alignment going on as well at the solstice, the winter solstice in 2012. But there's a planetary alignment going on right now, and it's going to be a great one, by the way, at the beginning of August. We should talk about that later. But the point is that even close objects like the moon, which has the most effect gravitationally, have absolutely no effect, except, of course, the tides, and the fishing is better on a full moon because of that, I'm told. So it really, the 2012 thing is just plain, ordinary, unequivocal hype, internet weirdness. And it reminds me of this old cartoon I saw. You remember with the guys who used to have the placards that said, "The world will end on Tuesday." Well, this guy had one of those placards, except he'd crossed out Tuesday and written down Wednesday. Because I think like in 2005 or something like that, some brown dwarf was going to come crashing in. Then this was predicted by some ancient calendar as well, and turn Earth on its side and destroy all life. And then, of course, the same thing was going to happen in the year 2000 on May 15th for a planetary alignment. So cross out 2005 and put down 2012. So that's...
Does our galaxy, does our solar system travel through the galaxy or rotate or circle the galaxy?
Yeah, I guess I should have said that. Earth travels along with the sun. So as the sun travels around the galaxy, so does Earth.
We get to go along.
That's right. It takes about 100 million years to make that orbit, so that a change from one year to the next, or even 1 million year to the next, does not appreciably change our position with respect to the other stars in the galaxy. And those stars are so very far away. Just to give you an example of what I mean by it, just to show you that the gravitational effect of all of this is negligible. When you think of the closest star to our sun, which would have more effect on us than the entire rest of the galaxy combined, if we made a little scale model and we made the sun, say, the size of a volleyball and Earth the size of the head of a pin, Earth would be about 1,000 yards away, 10 football fields away. The nearest star on that scale would be 5,000 miles away in Hawaii. So that the stars are so very far away from each other that even the generalized effect of the galaxy of 300 billion stars doesn't have much effect on Earth to start with. And secondly, that's not going to change much over a year or two. So if the world was going to end, it should have ended in 2010, and not, I mean, there's nothing about 2012 that makes it appreciably different from 2011.
Astronomically
speaking. Now, of course, we may very well destroy ourselves. We're capable of that now, but it won't happen because of astronomical events.
Okay, Chris.
You know, unless there's a killer asteroid.
thanks for your call, Chris.
And that could happen any time in the next 100 million years or so.
Well, speaking of asteroids, there's a new telescope in Hawaii. It's supposed to be the world's largest digital camera, which what does that mean? I mean, you can now fit them in your hip pocket.
You got a big old mirror, and it collects the light, and it projects it onto a CCD chip. And you should be very, very well aware of this, because on that scale, everybody owns a telescope because they own a lens with a digital chip. So what this is a really, really big digital camera. But these days, that's what all telescopes are. And part of its mission is, because it has a very wide field, is to look for asteroids.
Well, so is this just more hype then? Aren't they all looking for asteroids? I mean, if they see an asteroid, they'll tell us.
Let me put it to you this way. There are a lot of telescopes that aren't much good for anything else anymore. An old Schmidt camera, which is now converted to be a digital camera, that we had at the observatory at Perkins for many years. We moved out to Flagstaff, mm-hmm. and it is automated. Nobody has to do anything. Searching for asteroids as we speak, and it has discovered hundreds and hundreds of them, one of which, by the way, is named after me,
wow.
partly because I was the one who said it was okay to send that telescope. I think that's why I got an asteroid named after me. Yeah. But there's one named after Hiram Perkins, and there are now tens of thousands of these, and they're being discovered at all times. And some few of them actually have orbits that cross Earth's orbit.
So, how many telescopes are out there? Do you have any idea?
Oh, gosh.
I mean, the biggies.
Of biggies,
yeah.
Hundreds of huge ones and thousands and tens of thousands even ones that can be used for legitimate astronomy.
And then that doesn't count backyard.
That doesn't even count backyard telescopes.
That's just insane.
Which there must be hundred thousands of them.
Millions.
Millions even, yes.
Possibly.
But I guess only tens of thousands of those are actually being used because right. all the rest were bought at Walmart.
Or
some mart, and they look nice, but they're really not very good for astronomy.
Okay, we're going to take another short break. 614-292-8513 if you'd like to speak with Tom Burns, director of the Perkins Observatory, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
See the new lineup of public affairs programming on Friday nights from WOSU-TV. Starting at 8 is Washington Week, followed by Columbus on the Record at 8:30. Continuing at 9 is the McLaughlin Group. And at 9:30, PBS presents Need to Know, a new program with an innovative broadcast and web approach to news gathering and reporting. Watch the new public affairs lineup every Friday night beginning at 8 on WOSU-TV.
You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning. It's 40 minutes after 10 o'clock. Some sunshine with a slight chance of morning showers and thunderstorms today, a high around 85. Tonight should be clear skies with a low around 62. Some nice weather tomorrow, sunshine with a high of 85. And that includes Saturday with a sunny with a high around 88. Stay tuned for next hour with All Sides when U.S. Army Colonel and Ohio State University Military History Professor Peter Mansour discusses President Obama's decision to remove General Stanley McChrystal from his position as the top commander in Afghanistan. That's coming up in just about 20 minutes here on WOSU. Get the latest updates from NPR and WOSU News from the convenience of your computer by streaming on the web. You can listen online at WOSU.org and listen to archive news stories as well. Now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher here on WOSU.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Tom Burns. He's director of the Perkins Observatory. We've covered a lot of ground already, and we're supposed to be talking about the stars. So,
asteroids. Perkins Observatory. So, I like that. Yes,
Do you think we're ever going to get hit by an asteroid? I mean, a big one is. Do you think that could possibly happen?
I think it's inevitable. I think that if we don't watch out, sometime in the next couple of million years, it's going to happen. But the point is that. It's happening right now. You know, a trillion particles hit Earth's atmosphere every day. And maybe one or two of them actually hit the ground, or rather the ocean. It's more likely that they're going to hit the ocean. And do I think it's worth spending a few million dollars a year searching for Earth-crossing asteroids and predicting their orbits, et cetera? Yeah, sure. Why not? That's the ticket. Yeah. But, you know, as I often say, the chances of a life-threatening asteroid hitting the Earth are very good if you measure it over 100 million years. I mean, after all, it just happened 65 million years ago. Killed all the dinosaurs, although how they got all the dinosaurs to stand in one place, I'll never know.
You had to do the dinosaur joke.
I had to do the dinosaur joke, sorry. But there were other things involved. And nobody's really absolutely sure that that's what happened, by the way. But the chances of that happening are inevitable. But the chances only get good if you measure it over millions of years or even hundreds of millions of years and not, say, years. So the chances of this happening in my lifetime are very small indeed. In your lifetime, maybe a little bit longer.
So if all these telescopes are – my lifetime, trust me, Tom. If all these telescopes are hundreds of telescopes, the big fat ones are out there – scanning the night sky, what are the chances that we'll spot an asteroid, a deadly asteroid, that could mortally wound the world in time to do anything about it?
Well, that's the problem, of course. Even if we found out about it, and this is the beauty, we can detect these pretty far away because the telescopes are bigger now. So you see a speck of light, you look at it the next night, it's moved. You can, from just a few points of data, predict its orbit. And because we know Earth's orbit really, really well, and all of the gravitational influences that the planets cause, stretch that out into the future and predict if and when it's going to hit. So we might have decades, hundreds of years even, to predict when that's going to happen. Can we do anything about it now? Nah. But I'll bet you that if we engaged in a Manhattan project, we could figure out something, you know.
Because there'd be time.
Because there would be time, yes. On the other hand, if we detected one really fast, then we'd be in if we detected one that was going to happen fairly soon, we'd be in trouble. However, the likelihood of that happening is small. Because, really, we're scanning the sky at all times. And the chances of detecting one that is actually going to hit Earth in that orbit is fairly small. And these things have orbits that stretch from tens of years to hundreds of years or even thousands of years for the comets that go way out. So no problem.
Okay, no problems. No worries.
No worries.
614-292-8513. Adam, you're on the air with Tom Burns. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I just wanted to ask Tom what the validity is to the possibility of the solar system being a binary system, kind of like an offshoot of the 2012 hysteria on the internet and elsewhere.
Oh, the old brown dwarf thing, yes. That it's possible. But you would think that with the techniques that we have to develop, to understand the even the slightest changes, aberrations in the orbits of the planets, that we would be able to detect something as large as, say, a brown dwarf in orbit around the sun. So I would say that it's possible. It would have to be an object at some distance from the sun.
What's a binary system?
A binary, oh, yes. Two stars orbiting each other, kind of like your thumbs twiddling, except one twiddle might take, you know, tens or hundreds or thousands of years. Now, what makes this possible is that when we look at other stars in our Milky Way galaxy, we find very few stars that are loners, bachelor stars, they're called. Mostly we find binary and even multiple star systems. And just to mention it, that could have happened with our own sun. There is an object, Jupiter, which if it had been only nine times more massive than it is, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's not that much, then it would have been a so-called brown dwarf star, a star that just doesn't quite develop the oomph, the mass, to develop thermonuclear fusion and start, you know, producing the kind of energy that the sun does. But I think nine times bigger, it could have maybe even developed some form of thermonuclear fusion, become a star, but it didn't because it was too small. And that's just simply what happens, apparently, in solar systems, that you develop these big gas giant planets. I mean, we're detecting those all over the place around other stars. And if they get big enough, then they become stars of their own.
That ancient civilizations could have mistaken Jupiter for such an object.
No, because they would have recognized Jupiter as what it was, a planet. I mean, mistake Venus for it, because Venus is much brighter than Jupiter is in the sky. No, the planets were planets. That's how they got their name. The word planet meant wanderer. They didn't know they were balls in the sky. They thought they were gods.
Okay. Well, thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Adam. Take care.
All right, bye-bye, Bowie.
614-292-8513, or you can email us. We haven't gotten any emails today. It's so weird.
Come on, send me an email.
At allsides@wosu.
Call in, or they might start getting a real astronomer on instead of just an old stargazer like me.
Kathy, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Mr. Burns. It's just great to hear you. I have a couple questions, and I'll rattle them off and then just listen. I'd like to know if you've seen any UFOs, if you think that anybody is visiting our planet, if you've seen the movie The Fourth Kind, and I'll just listen for your answer. Thank you.
Thanks, Kathy.
I have not seen The Fourth Kind. Thank you, Kathy, for saying such nice things. But I'm going to have to say to you that I have never seen anything that I would classify as unidentified, although I have to confess to you, I've seen some things. I once saw a weather balloon illuminated by Columbus City lights. I once saw seagulls illuminated, the bottoms of their stomachs illuminated by city lights, and I said, oh, my God, this is the one. But it turned out to be seagulls. I saw them go over the horizon, and then I went, and I got in my car, and I drove in that direction, and I saw the seagulls all flying around this billboard light, and by God, they looked like UFOs. I once saw a weather balloon that moved oddly against the sky. It did not move at all, like you expect a plane to move or even a planet or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of zigging and zagging and moving around. And I got out my binoculars and I watched it boom, explode. Literally, explode into shards. And it took me a couple of days to find out what that one was, by gosh. But it was indeed a weather balloon. So, in other words, a lot of people look up and call the observatory and say, my gosh, there's a bright point of light and it's near the moon. And it's one very nice lady said to me, in fact, that it had rays coming out of it and it was trying to steal the moon. But the point is, she just didn't know that it was Venus. And I think that if you develop some knowledge of the sky, that it's less likely that you're going to see something you don't know what it is. In my case, I mean, I remember once a little spiral formed in the sky. I mean, it was at the Perseid meteor shower watch we were doing at High Banks, and I saw, I mean, hundreds of people saw this, and, you know, it took me about 3 days to find out that it was a Japanese rocket venting fuel forming this beautiful spiral in the sky. So, in other words, no, I haven't, and even though I reserve judgment on the question of whether other life exists on planets around other stars in our Milky Way galaxy or in other galaxies.
Extraterrestrial
life around exoplanets. I will say that I think the chances of them visiting here are small for about 100 different reasons. Main one, the stars are really far away and they would have to violate the laws of physics to get here rapidly. But secondly, the universe is vast. How would they know we are here? It would be like, you know, there are more stars, somebody once said, than all the grains of sands and all the beaches on Earth. And to find us, they'd have to be looking at just the right grain of sand to know that we're here in the first place.
In the movie Contact, the story Contact, obviously this is by Carl Sagan in the first place, there's the idea that yes, all that you just said is true, except that there may be other entities out there that are a heck of a lot smarter than we are.
Yeah, but you know, I just...
In a vast, incalculable way.
I don't care how smart they are. They aren't going to be able to violate Einstein's stricture, and it works that nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. And here's the worst thing, the closer you get to the speed of light, the greater your mass is. And you know, it's just going to be really, really hard to do that, to travel from star to star. And it'd be even hard to detect the life that you need to detect on Earth. To be able to, and you know, Sagan, and he freely admits in the novel that he's, in a foreword to the novel, that he's sort of stretching things to make this happen. These aliens were not close to us, but they had a detecting system on Vega or on a planet orbiting Vega,
right,
which happens to be close, and, you know, and all this
rigmarole
and to make it happen. And Carl Sagan, who this is his field of study, is studying the possibility of other life on other planets. And even he was extremely skeptical about these things. As a matter of fact, he wrote a book called Demon Haunted World, marvelous book, that just with a poo-pooed, I can't think of it, all these various weird theories that people are visiting us and things like that. So.
Well, that's the final word. God darn it, somebody called about a phone app for looking at the night sky and they hung up. So what do we know about that?
Oh, I have three of them right here, and oh, my God, I forgot
cool?
to turn off my cell phone. But I can map the sky. These are so cool. Just go to the App Store and type in star map. But let me see. Put on my glasses here. I have several of these. Let's see. Now, Star Walk is my favorite. Here's what's so cool about Star Walk. Two words, is you point it at the sky and it can tell from your iPhone what direction the iPhone is pointed, and it shows you what you're looking at. So if I pointed it over toward Venus, it would show me Venus. And it would show me if I pointed straight overhead and I'm looking at Cygnus, it would show me Cygnus and all the constellations around it. It is so cool, you betcha.
Okay, there are phone apps out there. Of course there are phone apps out there. 614-292-8513. Leslie, you're on the show. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question. Well, I have a couple of questions, actually. One concerns, I live out in the country. I have a pretty good view of the night sky, but I have a particularly great view of the southern sky. I know a lot of people look at the North Star and the northern.
Oh, you want to look south in the summer, that's for sure.
Well, there's a particular arrangement of stars that I've seen all summer long, and it's a sort of an isosceles triangle, and the top stars they're all three real bright stars. The top star is about 45 degrees above the horizon, and then about 20 degrees above the horizon is a star that forms the base, and then further to the west there's another star. It's about 30 degrees from the bottom first star, and it's about 20 degrees above the horizon.
But they're all pretty far apart, right?
They're all pretty far apart.
Yeah.
The one in the western sky seems to be moving a little bit. I mean, I don't know whether that's just I'm seeing things or what, but it seems to me that at the start of the summer, it was closer to the other base star. And I just wondered if there was a planet up there that I'm not aware of. Well, I usually look at the sky around 11, 12 o'clock at night.
Okay, very good. So if it's possible at 11 that you might be seeing Venus very low in the west. But chances are over in the west, you're seeing the planet Saturn or the planet Mars. There is a very nice triangle of stars, however. They're pretty far apart from each other, that if you look kind of east at about that time, you're going to be seeing pretty high in the sky, the star Vega. Over to the left, you're going to be seeing the star Deneb in the constellation Cygnus. And over to the right, if you're not seeing a planet, you're seeing the star Altair in the constellation Aquila. And that actually has a name. It's called the summer triangle. And it's what I'm always looking for, especially in the late summer, when I'm attending some conference or camping on in the backyard with my family, or at Shakespeare in the Park, as it's getting dark and I'm waiting for things to start, I'm waiting for Vega and Deneb and Altair to pop out in that beautiful summer triangle, it's called. And that may very well be what you're seeing.
Thanks for the call, Leslie. We've run out of time, Tom.
Oh.
It just flew by.
Just fly by.
Like
flies by when you're having a good time, yes.
My thanks to Tom Burns, director of Perkins Observatory. Hope you'll come back again soon.
Be glad to.
Okay.
Don't get me on before the winter solstice, because there's an eclipse of the moon, okay?
I will definitely get you on before the winter solstice. That is for sure. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. A program like this doesn't happen by magic. It's a dedicated behind-the-scenes team that does its work. Al DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. It was composed especially for the show. The All Sides staff includes producer Linda Taylor, associate producer Amy Jurovich, whose role is being filled today by Emma Fett, student production assistant Tyler Adams, radio operations director Kevin Petrilla, senior broadcast technician Eric French. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.